That's politics. That's politics. It's all about how much. And that's our politicians in New York.
Thank you, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, quoting indicted City Councilman Dan Halloran there. And from the biggest city in the culture of corruption empire state, it's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. A very special guest to get us rolling today, the former governor of the state of New York and now former WOR talk show host, I'm sorry to say, David Paterson. Governor, I missed you when you converted from guest to host, so I'm glad we can talk again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, good morning. It's wonderful to be back. I think you've been interviewing me for perhaps about 25 years.
I think so. And I will admit, though my radio show is usually set, my radio is usually set on WNYC. I used to listen to you and All Things Considered on my way home from work, and I thought you did a great job. What was it like for you being in the rough and tumble of opinionated commercial talk radio?
Well, what I would say is that in the beginning, I think they were surprised at how well I was able to do the show technically. I think I spent my whole life listening to talk radio, so I sort of understood how to do the commercial breaks and the introductions. But the problem I had was expressing myself, because in government, anything you say beyond what needs to be said can and will be used against you. And I think it took nearly a very long time, like 6 to 9 months, for that little red light to go off and for me to just say what I actually thought, because I was always afraid that it was going to be misconstrued. And it was actually a situation where it was, where I was admonishing a caller that if you really believe that President Obama was not born in the United States, that's fine that he believes that, but that this argument had already been litigated in the public and nobody wants to hear it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if you think he got away with it, then he got away with it. You know, but you're going to have to find another issue for the public to reject President Obama's reelection bid. Well, next thing I looked up and they wrote in the newspaper the next day that I said I didn't believe that President Obama was born in the United States, which wasn't the truth. And but I found that when that happened and I was able to go on the show and clear the air and actually play the tape of the interview back, that it made me feel a lot more relaxed. So I really enjoyed the time. I, you know, hope to do it again sometime. And you know, if anybody ever goes on vacation, is looking for someone to stand in for them, I might be willing to do it.
I don't know who you could possibly have in mind. You were on, before we get off this and on to corruption in New York, you were on, for the most part, as your story indicates, a very right-wing station. You were Michael Savage's lead-in, for heaven's sakes. You can't get much more hardcore.
I was Michael Savage's lead-in, and I followed Lou Dobbs.
There you go. So did that make it hard for your show to succeed over there?
Well, it did, because I didn't have the same ideological point of view as most of my listeners. But I thought that what did happen as time went on is that I was able to present a show fairly, and that I was able to try to bring both sides to the table, which I don't think happens. It happens here on your show, but you don't hear it too much in talk radio. It's a rant that goes on for 2 or 3 hours from whoever is the host. It's almost scripted. You know exactly what people are going to say before they say it.
Yeah.
But we had some really interesting situations, and there were times when I actually agreed with my conservative callers.
Yes.
And
I heard those times, and I was surprised at some of those times. But certainly you were trying to give everybody a voice. And I would say that the show you were doing on WOR would not have been transplantable to, say, MSNBC, because it wasn't just you as a Democrat talking a party line. And maybe that also made it hard for you to succeed in commercial radio because people want it black and white.
Yeah. The difficult thing for me is that the actual best ratings that I got, the best time, in other words, where the show was improving, was right before I was released. So.
Right. But you were released, and I should say this as somebody who's been through it, you were released when the station changed ownership. And
yeah,
there
yeah,
is no shame for a radio professional in being let go as a host when a radio station changes ownership. It happens all
the
time.
I cracked the joke. We were released about 5 days before Christmas, and as I was leaving, I went in this boardroom where some of the new administrators were, and I said, wow, you guys are tough. Even when I was governor, they let me stay to the end of the year.
There you go. All right, well, let's go to another seamier part of your resume. Before you were governor, before that. How many years were you Senate Minority Leader and in the legislature altogether?
I was a Minority Leader for 4 years, and I was in the Senate for 21 years.
And has the legislature changed since you were a Senate Minority Leader, or was it always this corrupt?
Well, I would say by the time I became Minority Leader, I was starting to see the change. But I think that the caliber of legislator, of state senator and assembly member, has diminished considerably in New York State. And it's not just character. People don't prepare as much. They don't know the issues. They don't spend time with their colleagues of opposing points of view to try to learn something. They don't travel around the state to places that they'd never visited before to try to get a holistic view of public policy. And you don't hear passionate movements or arguments on either side coming out of Albany as much as you did back in the 80s. And, of course, as a young person, I used to watch my father in the legislature in the 60s. And I think that because of that, the temptations of indecent activity become greater because the individuals who are running for office, this is the biggest thing they've ever done. But for the first time, they go to Albany, and they're around a lot of money, lobbyists. And I'm not making up excuses for anything they did. People should be punished for the crimes they've committed. But I do think that there's a watered-down intellect and experience that we see in Albany these days. Not everybody. There are some stunning exceptions to that, but I'd just say on the whole.
But why would this be so different from 10 years ago or 15, 20 years ago?
Well, I think that our best and our brightest are eschewing the opportunity to go into government. In other words, government doesn't have a great reputation. The 24-hour news cycle, I know, has intimidated a lot of people from running for office. They don't need every little thing they did in their life to be dug up and to be ridiculed that way. Mm-hmm. Also, the pay, in my opinion, we have a state that has 200,000 employees, has a value of $300 billion if you add the budget and the funds distributed by the controller together. And our CEO, the governor, makes less than the average first-year associate in a law firm in New York State.
Yeah.
Our legislators make $80,000 a year. Now, upstate, that means a lot more than it does here. But right here in New York City, $80,000 isn't going to get you much. And again, I'm not making up excuses for
right.
people who broke the law.
But it's the combination. And you know what? I was talking to a leader of the business community in New York off the record the other day, and this person said to me a combination of the things you've just been saying, which is for a lot of these lawmakers who come from community roots, often humble backgrounds, being in the legislature is the biggest thing that they've ever done. It's the biggest thing that their families have ever known. And they make only $80,000 a year. Again, not that that's poverty wages, but it's pretty modest. And they have to go back and forth to Albany all the time and all of this stuff. And then there's all this temptation that's put in front of them because there are a lot of people who would want to give them money to influence policy or contracts or things like that. And it's a combustible mix.
Well, Brian, temptation shouldn't be discounted. We found with drugs that when drugs were placed in places like Harlem and the South Bronx and Jamaica, that you had high uses of drugs. But then when those drugs leaped the ghetto walls and started going to places like Forest Hills and Groves Point, we had drug problems there as well. And I think the temptations of greed and money and wealth, you have a lot of people who are elected to office. They call themselves senator. You know, the staff has to bow and scrape when they come through the door. But they really are, in a sense, leading a double life because they don't have the capacity to influence situations the way it's represented that they do. And
right.
I think a lot of people start grasping to try to attain that power that is perceived by their constituents. I think the biggest problem with all of us when we were in public offices that we think that we're a big deal and we're really just elected members of the community.
Former Governor David Paterson. Were you and Malcolm Smith in the state senate at the same time? Did you know him as a suspect character?
No, I didn't know him as a suspect character, and we were in the state senate together for 8 years, and he then succeeded me as a minority leader and one of the people who advocated very strongly for me to be in the minority. Malcolm was a kind of independent-minded person. He voted with the Republicans a lot, and he sort of weaved back and forth. He endorsed Mayor Bloomberg in 2005. So, you know, we had our political disagreements, but I was absolutely stunned to hear this. And there's a part of me that prays that this just isn't true and he'll be vindicated. But, you know, you have to respect our United States attorney and our criminal justice system. And if they brought these charges, this is very serious.
Assuming the charges are true, how could he be so clueless as to think he could win a Republican primary and be elected mayor and that a spot in the Republican primary was worth bribing people for?
Yeah, Brian, you know, there are a lot of people I've seen who I thought ran for office. They knew they couldn't win, but they were just kind of, you know, using it for publicity or maybe training themselves for a future campaign or something such as that.
Yeah.
I didn't think Malcolm was serious about running for mayor. He didn't have, I thought, the kind of credentials that would earn him that opportunity. He had never held a borough-wide or city-wide office. And so what's even more mind-boggling, and again, we're talking about accusations, is that most of what the accusation is illegal could have been done legally. I mean, the interesting thing is the way our campaign finance system is right now, and I think it really is sorely in need of change, that you can pretty much do what they are alleged to have been doing without breaking the law. People do it all the time. They have a legally established mechanism for trying to bribe people. It's called fundraising.
Right. And, you know, and I was going to bring it up. Because to me, the bigger problem than illegal corruption, by far, is legal corruption. There will always be a few scoundrels in office selling a state contract here or a ballot line there. But do you agree that the bigger problem is the money that the special interests can lavish on politicians in campaign fundraising and lobbying?
I mean, Brian, I think it's the elephant in the room, and it's not time for us to start talking about it. I mean, people came up with all kinds of excuses for this latest corruption scandal, including the fact that we have to have bipartisan elections. In other words,
nonpartisan elections.
We should have
like
nonpartisan
Mayor
elections.
Mayor Bloomberg wants that.
Right. But that has nothing to do with the corruption. These were people who were trying allegedly to weld power and to use resources to gain influence. Well, this is done all the time because we don't limit campaign finance. And New York City probably has tried as hard as any other government to try to rein this under control. But right now, you know, under our federal laws, you really can't stopping someone from spending their own money.
Governor Spitzer failed to get campaign finance reform. In fact, it wound up with his Troopergate scandal just for trying. You tried, and I think you got a little piece of what you wanted. Now Governor Cuomo is trying as part of his new bill. Why is it so hard?
Well, I think it's so hard because it's something that it's very hard for the people who benefit from it to let it go. And in other words, it really is the engine of the political economy. And, you know, we had legislation, Brian, where it would sunset every 2 years, particularly a lot of union contracts and that kind of thing. And we'd go in and vote for it again every 2 years. Why? Because every 2 years we'd make sure that the unions were funding us.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean,
And we have to acknowledge, honestly, that, and we did a show on this recently, we looked at the top 10 lobbying spenders in New York State for last year. And four of the top 10 are unions, public sector unions, in fact. And so for people who want to say, oh, this is all about business, well, it's largely about business, but it's also largely about public sector unions.
Right. And in a sense, in this you know, kind of scam, there's a legislation known as agency shop. And the way it would work is every 2 years they had to ante up, or we wouldn't extend certain protections that they had. And it's just so categorically. I mean, it is the only difference between what we saw last week and this is that it's legal. But the same public policy that we're trying to prevent is affected by this. And I got to tell you, sometimes some of the same advocates for this type of reform, particularly journalists, will write, well, so-and-so probably can't win for re-election because they haven't raised enough money, as if you should spend more time raising money than being in government.
And then you don't even cover somebody if you don't think that they can raise enough money because you dismiss them as an unserious candidate.
Exactly.
How about the Cuomo reform plan that he released this week, which includes some campaign finance reform? It's mostly focused on illegal corruption. What do you think of it?
I think that Governor Cuomo, if he were here talking with us right now, would acknowledge that it's a step in the right direction, but it's kind of like a draft. In other words, I think what the governor is doing, and this is what the governor does very well, if there is a major catastrophe, the governor has a plan, and it may not be a complete plan, but I think it's very important for the public to see that the leader of this state is not ignoring what's going on. So, you know, I think eventually he can figure out what he wants to do. There isn't very much in there about lobbying. There isn't very much in there about campaign finance. He wants to expand the ability of district attorneys to get involved, because that came up in this case, and this is very poignant, that the district attorneys thought that the case was too big for them and they had to go to the U.S. attorney.
Huh.
So I think he's on the right track, and this is very similar to the instant reaction that New York State had to the gun issue, as opposed to a lot of states that, you know, haven't addressed it at all.
Right. My guest for another just a very few minutes, former Governor David Patterson. And let me touch on some other things while you're here. You're still on the MTA board, aren't you?
Last I checked, yes.
And, I mean, that followed you even after being governor. So in that capacity, did you work closely with Joe Loda, now the leading Republican mayoral candidate, when he was the CEO? And is there anything about his management style and, you know, what it says about what kind of mayor he would make?
Tremendous manager, very, very a technical administrator. I mean, he knew... he's a hands-on administrator. He has all of those skills, and I think was a terrific chair while he was there. I didn't stay on the MTA board. I wasn't on the MTA board as governor. I was appointed there by Governor Cuomo, by the way.
Oh, I see. Okay, forgive me. So when Loda was deputy mayor and budget director in the Giuliani administration, he had a reputation of being part of that, you know, Giuliani team of hard-driving, with-us-or-against-us types. But he seems to have mellowed, perhaps, from what I can tell. An impression?
Well, I actually knew Joe outside of politics. He was an investment banker, a very good friend of mine. So I've known him about 30 years. Yeah, I would say Joe's mellowed a lot in the last 30 years.
Well, we'll talk. We'll see if we have reason to talk more about him. If he wins the Republican primary, he's actually there in the November race. Anthony Weiner, think he could beat the current, never mind all this hand-wringing about whether he's rehabilitated enough and what he did and should he throw out his Twitter account, blah, blah, blah. Do you think he could beat the current Democratic field for mayor if he jumps in?
I think he'd be a viable alternative to the candidates who are there. And I think that he would be a factor if he decided to get in the race. And I think that the polls showed that. The only thing I think that Anthony Weiner did wrong is when you want to show contrition, there has to be resurrected. You have to be dead first. So I think what was wrong, and this is just me as a political strategist thinking, you can't have an article in New York Magazine, oh, I'm sorry, I'm crying. Oh, and by the way, I'm running for mayor.
Mm-hmm.
You have to let that sink in. And I don't think Anthony Weiner is running for mayor. I think he's letting it sink in because I think he knows he needs another year or two, and then it is very possible he may be mayor one day. He has all the skills and ability that a person would need.
Last thing. Let me come back to your WOR show for just a second. I'm curious if you experienced much racism from callers beyond the policy differences with a mostly conservative listenership. Did ugly stuff come to the surface once people got going?
Not as much as perhaps I anticipated. I think that the WOR audience is very conservative, but particularly with me was willing to hear the other side, and it's why I remember it as one of the best experiences in my life. I thought that the callers were very decent to me. One day, somebody called up and called me a BB, a blind bastard. Hmm. And I said, well, they got it half right.
Yeah, they left out another B, though, that they might have thrown in there.
Yes, but I didn't experience much of that. What I would say what's interesting now about racial issues is that they're more tangential. They're not as direct as they were in the past. In other words, that people may not even realize that they're saying things that, you know, are somewhat offensive, because I don't know deep down if they mean it as much as they did years ago.
Former Governor David Paterson, thank you very much. A lot of good insights. Good to talk to you again. We'll talk soon.
I hope so.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, Heidi Moore from The Guardian on winners and losers in the Obama budget. Stay with us.